Ultimate MBA Admissions Podcast. I'm very excited to launch into the next episode in our series, which focuses on the recent U.S. News and World Report MBA rankings for 2019, which came out a week ago today. We know that our audience is well familiar and waits for these rankings with bated breath. So we won't spend a whole lot of time on the rankings themselves. I'll run down the list of top 10 just to refresh anyone. But then we're going to spend the rest of the podcast diving into some key insights from the rankings. So the big news was that the University of Chicago Booth School of Business rose to take the top spot that had been held by Harvard and University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School last year. Harvard stayed, so there's a tie at number one between Harvard and Chicago Booth. Wharton slipped to third. Stanford stayed steady at fourth. MIT Sloan School of Management slipped to fifth from the tie it held with Stanford at fourth last year. Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management saw a bigger slip to sixth from a three-way tie it held at fourth last year. Berkeley's Haas School of Business stayed steady at seven. The University of Michigan's Ross School of Business was one of the big headlines in the 2019 MBA rankings. It broke the top 10 for the first time since 2005. Not only did it break into the top 10, it actually landed at seventh to share that spot with Berkeley Haas. Columbia stayed steady at nine, and Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business slipped from eighth, but still eked out a spot in the top 10, coming in as 10th. With that, as a refresher, I'm going to turn to Graham Richmond and invite him to share with me some of his key takeaways. Graham, as you look at this most recent rankings out of U.S. News, what were some of the things that jumped off the page for you?
Hi, Jeanette. Thanks so much for having me back on the podcast. Yes, the U.S. News 2019 rankings are out, and they were the talk of the MBA admissions universe last week. As to what kind of stood out for me, I would say that the emergence of Booth in the top spot, obviously in a tie with HBS, is big news. It's not a school that we typically see at the top of the pack where U.S. News rankings are concerned. So that was big news. And I agree, you kind of pointed this out just moments ago, but I agree that Ross, their move into the top 10 and not, you know, hanging out at the very back, but literally right up into the tie at number seven with Haas was impressive. I do think that one of the other things that struck me was just the way in which some of the salary and kind of job placement metrics can impact schools' standing. So we saw Yale SOM kind of drop down out of the top 10. We see Stanford hanging on at number four, but, you know, kind of arguably a little bit lower than it should be. And I think that some of this is, you know, has to do with placement statistics and the fact that, you know, Stanford sending a lot of people off into entrepreneurial endeavors where there isn't a big salary attached, particularly if you're starting your own company, and Yale still having some real strengths in the nonprofit sector, which ultimately does serve to lower the average starting salary for their graduates. So it kind of brought into focus that aspect of this ranking. And I think, you know, for some folks, you know, you need to be able to get into the nitty-gritty of, like, sort of, well, what's the average starting salary for a Yale grad who goes into strategy consulting versus nonprofit, rather than blending those together since they're obviously so different. So those are just a few of the things that struck me right out of the gate with this year's ranking.
So Graham, that's interesting what you pointed out in terms of schools where it makes sense to dig into the employment reports, because as we know, the U.S. News rankings favor schools that have strong employment stats. And so a school like Yale, as you pointed out, might have a lower overall average starting salary package because they send a large percentage, or a larger than other schools percentage, of their students into nonprofit. But that doesn't mean that they're not performing really well in strategy consulting. But to that point, I think that here, there's another point to be made. So Stanford, even though, as you point out, sends lots of its students into entrepreneurship where they may not be drawing a salary at all, it doesn't really have that much of an impact on average starting salaries, because Stanford still had the highest average starting salary, even factoring in the entrepreneurship students. But what it does impact, and why it is still important in the U.S. News ranking, and why Stanford may have had trouble getting up to 1, 2, or 3, is because a big part of the U.S. News methodology is based on recruiter scores. And these startups are not the recruiters that are providing these scores. So it could be that the greater push toward entrepreneurship at Stanford, even though it's not necessarily hurting the overall starting salary, it does mean that this component made up of responses from recruiters is not as strong out of a Stanford as it might be out of another school.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think there are two other things to think about. So in particular with a school like Stanford, we've got a scenario where, as you correctly point out, you know, the recruiter surveys are probably not coming from the tiny startups that just received, you know, venture funding and are hiring an MBA or two. And so, you know, there's that aspect, as you point out. But I think another thing is that, you know, at a place like Stanford, I think some students hedge their bets, right? So they go out and they recruit for consulting, but they're also looking at startups. And I think, you know, it only takes a student or two to kind of get a couple of offers from consulting firms, but then, you know, dip their toes into the entrepreneurial pipeline and look at jobs there, only to ultimately decide on an entrepreneurial path. And that may make recruiters feel like, gosh, you know, we love Stanford, it's a great school, but we know that our yield is not as good there. And that could make some recruiters a little disappointed in terms of, you know, gosh, we thought we had this person and here they are heading off to, you know, startup company X. So there's that aspect. And then the other thing I was going to say is that in both Stanford and Yale's case, if you think about, you know, kind of startup type jobs as well as nonprofit jobs, that portion of the recruiting market is much slower to develop. So if we start to talk about percentage of candidates with full-time offers upon graduation, those stats may come into play in different ways, because, you know, the banks and the consulting firms, they kind of wrap everything up very early on, so that most of the candidates who would be graduating from a top business school have for many months had that job by the time graduation rolls around, whereas the market for startup positions or nonprofit is often a little bit slower to develop and it's not as routinized. So I think those are things to consider as well.
And I would add one more point, which is, as you pointed out about Stanford, many students there feel like they have the ability to really pick and choose. And that can sometimes lend itself to holding out for the perfect job as opposed to taking the pretty good job that's right there. And that has hurt Stanford in the past in terms of the stat about how many students seeking offers accepted them 3 months out from graduation. And Stanford has historically, and I think rightly, argued that part of that is our students can be choosier and take longer and still be assured of a job. But I also know that Stanford was really sensitive. They had a lower than usual percent with jobs 3 months out, and were really glad to have raised that sum this year because they recognize that it hurts them in this ranking.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do think that this is going back a ways, but if you think about the first kind of big tech wave in the late 90s, when I was actually getting an MBA at Wharton, there was this, you know, kind of rush towards tech companies and startup type positions. And, you know, a lot of the consulting firms and banks and even corporates were sort of left standing at the altar a little bit. And there was a, you know, and I think we're in a kind of second wave of that sort of behavior. You really see tech jobs, you know, in many cases eclipsing finance jobs. And, you know, there's a bit more of a, you know, kind of startup wave these days. And, you know, now that we're kind of firmly out of the 2008 financial crisis. So yeah, there are all these factors that come into play. And when the economy is really good and the job market is hot, as it has been for the last couple of years now, it's, yeah, there's a, as you said, candidates can be choosy. And what that ends up doing is it sometimes makes employers feel a little nervous about, you know, well, what's our likelihood of getting this person? So they know people have more options.
I think a lot of what we've been talking about comes back to things we might have touched on in an earlier podcast about how to use rankings overall. I think the point here is that, you know, don't take things necessarily at face value. If a school that you're really interested in seems to have performed not as well on this ranking as you anticipated, dig into the numbers and understand a little bit more about, you know, how that individual school is supported or perhaps countered against in the methodology used by U.S. News. And I would say you'd need to do that with every school and every ranking, figure out what it is the ranking is measuring and whether or not that's a fair measure for the school that you're interested in, and particularly for what you're interested in pursuing at that school.
Absolutely. And I really strongly encourage everyone to go and listen to the podcast that we produced on how to use MBA rankings in general, whether it's US News or Business Week or the FT, because it's a podcast that has a lot of really good advice. And it's been our most popular episode to date. So I encourage people to listen to that, because we did make the point that you have to, yeah, take these rankings with a grain of salt, and more importantly, with, I guess, a grain of their methodology, like an understanding of their methodology, because it really does influence the way things shake out.
Next up, I wonder if you'll talk a little bit about the M7 and how it was represented in the top 10 of the U.S. News. And what that means, whether that was surprising, whether that was as you would expect it. Maybe start out by letting any listeners new to the world of MBA know what the M7 stands for.
Yeah, so the M7 is stands for the Magnificent Seven, which is the group of seven kind of top U.S. MBA programs. Generally, you know, people, obviously I have seen different versions of the seven, but the version that I know and that I think most people in the industry would readily agree on is there's kind of Harvard and Stanford and Wharton in the group. Then you have the two top MBA programs in Chicago, in Kellogg and Booth, and then MIT and Columbia kind of round out the group. So that is the M7. And as you can see in the U.S. News 2019 MBA ranking, we have all those seven schools. Six of them are the top six. And then it's really just Columbia that has been, you know, kind of pushed back a little bit as Haas and Ross kind of jumped in at the number seven slot. So they're all there. I think that, you know, it has to do to some extent when it comes to why is Columbia not with the rest in this group. I think some of it has to do with, you know, rising cost of living in New York, as well as the kind of decline in interest among applicants in the financial sector, which traditionally, you know, had been a real strength for Columbia. And finally, you know, if you look at schools like MIT and even Ross, Haas, virtually, I guess, every school in the you know, the seven or so schools that are, well, I guess there are eight schools ahead of them in this ranking, they all have new facilities or facilities that have come online in the last, you know, sort of 10 to 15 years. And Columbia is working on a really impressive new campus in Manhattanville, kind of north of where the current school sits, but it's not ready yet. And it sounds like it's, you know, still maybe several years off. But I think that to some extent, you know, candidates are going to places like Berkeley or Kellogg and seeing these really lovely facilities. And, you know, MIT Sloan has a building that came online just a few years ago. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of a, you know, it could be that could be playing a factor as well in terms of candidates' preferences for these programs.
Excellent point. In our takeaways, one thing that we pointed to was the fact that there weren't actual huge surprises in either, and we've been focusing thus far on the top 10, but even as you got down to the top 16 or even the top 20, what do you think explains that, and sort of what's a takeaway from the fact that no, I mean, again, we were all pleasantly surprised to see Ross shoot up, and that's a big deal for Ross. But most of the characters are the cast of characters that we would expect to see in the top 20.
Yeah, I mean, we see this obviously on our site. Candidates are reporting decisions using our social tool called DecisionWire, and so they're sharing, you know, where they got in, where they choose to attend, et cetera. And so we see behavior that suggests, you know, that there is this group of 20 or so schools that tend to be consistently viewed as better than the rest. And they're all here. I do think, you know, sometimes the cynic in me wonders whether some shuffling of the deck happens each year in these rankings just within the 20 in order to basically sell magazines and generate, you know, web traffic. There's always sort of subtle changes to the methodology. There are kind of slight movements, you know, in the raw data that I think does merit some of these schools moving up and down. But, you know, our view, and this is something that we've harped on in some of our other podcasts and that we obviously write a great deal about on our website, but our view is that there are really more tierings of schools. And so some of these movements, you know, whether Booth is, you know, kind of better than Kellogg and MIT or not, are kind of, they're not as important as some of the rankings make them seem, because obviously some of these schools are just, they're sort of in a tier, or, you know, group of peer schools that are actually quite similar, especially when we look at applicant behavior. So I'll give you a very clear example. So, you know, Chicago Booth sits at number one this year, tied with HBS. And obviously that's a great accomplishment for that program. And it is, you know, clearly one of the best programs in the world. And yet I don't expect to see, you know, candidates flocking onto our site, reporting decisions where they've gotten into, say, Harvard Business School or Stanford, and Booth, and choosing Harvard choosing Booth over Harvard or Stanford. And that's not to take anything away from Booth's ranking here, but I just think that the marketplace seems to reflect a slightly different reality. And it's a reality that's more around tierings. And, you know, we talk a lot about this on the site, but, you know, there's a consensus around the fact that there is kind of a top tier, which might be Harvard and Stanford. Then there's kind of tier 1A, which might have Wharton in it. And then another tier that probably encompasses the likes of Chicago and Kellogg and MIT, maybe Columbia. So we view these as kind of groupings. And I think that's sort of what happens when we look at, you know, the marketplace and customer behavior or kind of student behavior, whereas the rankings try to sort of set this very ordinal, oh no, this school's number 7, it's not number 8, you know, like there's a big difference there. And yet, you know, we did see that as well. One of the takeaways we discussed in an article we published on the day that the rankings were released was that there's a lot of bunching in this ranking.
Right. I think there were 14 ties in the top 50 schools alone. Including multiple 3- and 4-way ties.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's some 3- and 4-way ties. So I think that definitely tells you that the rankings are close and that there's probably not a lot of distinction between some of these closely ranked schools on the list.
One of our colleagues, Alex Brown, was, again, happy to see Ross move up and said Ross is a great program. But he didn't think it belonged at number 7. He thought the top 7 is traditionally occupied by the M7 schools, of which Ross is not one. But there are a lot of reasons why Ross made it into the top 10 this year. What were some that stood out for you?
Yeah, I think there are several reasons why they're sort of a school on the rise. I mean, obviously, they have this kind of energetic, relatively new dean, Scott DeRue. And, you know, I guess they moved up last year from 12th to 11th, and then this year from 11th to 7th. So they're kind of, you know, there's some momentum. I also think if you just look at some of the raw stats around average GMAT score, average GPA, or even just application volume, these are all metrics that are moving in the right direction for Ross. I think, you know, I have to say, sometimes the value of the admissions team is greater than I think even the schools themselves understand. You know, the people that the school puts in front of candidates, that is, you know, the dean of admissions and whoever she hires to work under her, are really important because they're kind of customer facing. And so they're kind of the conduit through which, you know, people experience the school. I've always really been impressed with Soojin Kwon's leadership at Ross and the direction she's taken the admissions team in. So she, you know, has been terrific for several years. And so I think the combination of, you know, she's a Ross grad, incredibly charismatic, really great at kind of pitching the school. They have this terrific new dean, as I said. And again, the numbers are moving in the right direction in terms of application volume, GMAT scores, and GPA. So it's not surprising to see, based on the way U.S. News, you know, does this ranking, it's not surprising to see them moving up.
And I'm not sure how, if at all, this would impact the metrics that U.S. News uses. But I have to say, as a journalist covering the top-tier MBA programs, Ross, hands down, does the best job of marketing itself. And that makes a difference over time. They get marketing. Kellogg's pretty good, too. But it stands out in terms of getting prospective applicants the information that they need in a transparent way when they need it. They've got an easy-to-navigate website. They just are really doing things right in that regard, from this one person's opinion. But
that's my opinion as well. I mean, we see that just in the way that, our interactions with Ross, the applicant pool's interactions with the school. I think that their use of a kind of team-based interview in the admissions process has been innovative and done in a way that's quite different from, say, Wharton's use of a team-based discussion. So I think they're just doing a lot of things that are innovative on both the kind of admissions process and the kind of marketing, you know, fronts.
I'm going to ask you to return to an insight that we did allude to earlier on, but maybe go into a little greater depth about Yale SOM's slip out of the top 10 and what that might mean or not mean in terms of the quality of an education that you get there, why the U.S. News methodology may penalize Yale in particular.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting how, you know, immediately upon the release of these rankings, people were, you know, coming out in droves to say, you know, the obviously Yale has Dean Schneider has announced that he's going to be leaving. And so there was this whole kind of like, you know, conspiracy theory around the fact that, you know, this is a school in decline and they're losing their dean. And I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, to me, it's still a school that's very much on the rise. They have absolutely fantastic facilities. Anyone who has not been, I really encourage, you know, visit the campus if you're considering Yale, because they just have a stunning facility. It's a really close-knit, small program. And I think, you know, the fact of the matter is that they slipped out of the top 10. And where did they land? You know, you would think that they landed at number 20 from the way people were talking about this. No, they just landed at number 11, right? And as we've just said earlier in this podcast, it's not, you know, there's not really a material difference, you know, between some of these movements from like 10 to 11 or 7 to 8, et cetera. So I think, you know, this is a little bit much ado about nothing. And I think, you know, as we said earlier, some of this comes back to the fact that Yale has long had a reputation for being strong in the nonprofit sector. It's also a great school for finance and consulting. I mean, its proximity to New York City gives it terrific access to the job market there. It is an Ivy League school with an incredibly robust alumni network. So there are all kinds of reasons that Yale's great for placement in any number of domains. But one of the kind of niches that they've carved out over the years, and certainly in their early history, was around nonprofit. And that still is present there. And so there are a subset of the student body that, you know, focus on that area. But that serves to probably lower the percentage of candidates that are employed upon graduation because of the fact that the nonprofit job market is a bit slower to develop than the traditional recruiting on the banking and consulting side. And, you know, in addition, salaries are less, and even the notion of like signing bonuses, which is commonplace, you know, for banks and consulting firms, is just not, it's not happening on the nonprofit side for obvious reasons, right? So I think, yeah, this is, you know, so I think Yale's being penalized probably unfairly by the way that this ranking is structured. And I would say, you know, anyone who wants to work in banking or consulting or even tech, you know, look at the Yale placement statistics with a finer tooth comb than perhaps U.S. News is.
And I thought it was really interesting and really a pretty classy response. The day that the rankings went out, Dean Ed Snyder posted a blog, a blog post on the Yale SOM site titled simply Yale SOM Rankings Update. And it didn't say that it was in response to U.S. News, and it wasn't at all defensive, but it simply laid out Yale's ranking in each of five major rankings and then went on to detail exactly how each of those rankings arrives at their list. So it really gave prospective applicants the tools they need to understand how each of these rankings are measuring Yale and to decide whether or not that's the best measurement in terms of their own goals.
Right. And I think it's not, it's important to not lose sight of the bigger picture here, which is, you know, I've been in this industry for longer than I would care to admit. But back in like sort of 1995, when I was also looking at these rankings, it would have been the idea that we would be debating whether Yale is top 10 or number 11 would have been absurd, because the school wasn't even really, you know, kind of anywhere close in terms of the rankings in that respect. I mean, they were kind of a, you know, back end of the top 20 type school. And so they've made tremendous strides and built what I think is a really terrific, again, close-knit kind of small MBA program, which benefits from, you know, not only its Ivy League reputation, but its proximity to markets like, you know, New York City and Boston. So again, yeah, sometimes I think it's important to not just look at one ranking and one year's movement in that ranking and draw big conclusions from it.
And so we are up to our final insight from the 2019 U.S. News MBA rankings. And here we wanted to take a look at the strong performance of two other schools, the University of Washington's Foster School of Business and Rice University's Jones Graduate School of Business. Foster just missed making the top 20. They came in at 22nd, and that was really because two schools tied for 20th. So they were essentially 21st. And Rice bounced back from 29th last year to 23rd this year. They are strong finishes for these two schools. Are these schools to watch? What do you think is going on with their strong performance in this ranking?
Yeah, I think they're definitely schools to watch. I think that, you know, for slightly different reasons, I mean, there's some commonality, which I'll explain in a moment, but I think there are also some slightly different reasons that they're doing well. Obviously, you know, one thing that I think we have to point out that the schools share as a kind of common thread is I think they're benefiting from sort of industry specific geographies. And what I mean by that is, I mean, Foster is, you know, on the doorstep of entities like Amazon and Microsoft. And we know that those two companies in particular are just snatching up MBAs right and left. I mean, they're probably two of the bigger hirers of MBAs. I believe Amazon is the largest hirer of MBAs out there. And so I think Foster is benefiting from that proximity. It's a really high quality school in a market that, you know, doesn't have a top 10 MBA program at the moment, right? So I think they're really benefiting from that geography. Similarly, I think, you know, as we know, Rice being in Houston benefits from both the kind of energy sector and you know, obviously lots of opportunities there across Texas, and also from the kind of tech hub around even a city like Austin, which isn't so far away. So I think that, you know, you have both of these schools benefiting, and you can see that. I mean, obviously they're I guess it was for Foster, I think it was like 85% of the class was employed, you know, by graduation. And I think Rice, maybe 83%. So these are schools that are, you know, clearly placing their students. In the case of Rice, one other thing I would just like to mention is, I mean, it's a school that at the undergraduate level has this tremendous reputation. It's a top, top school. And really always has been. I think that the business school or Rice Business, as they like to call themselves, is, you know, sort of still kind of a new kid on the block in some respects, in terms of gaining the kind of national or global, you know, reputation. And they've been just, you know, doing a lot of good things. They have a great dean. I just feel like both of these schools are schools to watch. I don't see them, you know, jumping into the top 10 or anything, but I think that, you know, if I were schools 15 through 20 or so, I would be keeping an eye on them as those, you know, as these programs kind of move up.
And I'll just point out that if you are interested in tech as your post-MBA career, there is no school that comes close to the percentage of graduates it sends into tech than Foster. Foster this past year sent an incredible 52% of MBA graduates into the class of 2016.
Right.
Into tech.
Yeah.
So something to be said for location and the proximity to these industries.
Yeah, and I think that's something that people discount, meaning when people are shopping for an MBA program, I feel like, you know, there's not enough emphasis placed on geography. You know, I mean, people always talk about, well, I'm going to go to the school that I get into that's, you know, the highest ranked. And that's fine to say. But the reality is that, you know, some people might argue that Chicago Booth is a more highly ranked school than London Business School. But if you want to work in London, you know, you may want to go to LBS, even though maybe it's not quite the same ranking or something, right? So there are all kinds of reasons that geography can play a role, whether it's a kind of industry-specific geography or just, you know, a personal preference for where you want to be. And my sense in terms of looking at alumni presence over the years from each of these, you know, top 20 type MBA programs is that, you know, for better or for worse, the clusters, the students and the graduates really end up clustering around the major metros in which these programs are located. So, you know, you'll find the highest concentration of, you know, Wharton graduates in places like New York City, which is, you know, just up the road from Philadelphia. And similarly, you know, if you look at UCLA grads, there are a lot of them in California. I mean, it's just sort of the fact of the matter. And I think people sort of underestimate that geographical pull. Even a school like Stanford, which is, you know, some would argue best school in the world, or, you know, certainly number one or two or whatever, they place a ton of their graduates in California. And so, you know, if you know you want to be on the East Coast, you might argue that, you know, being at a place like Wharton might be a better bet. You know, so I think it's just important to kind of keep these things in mind, that it's not as simple as just choosing the school that's most highly ranked. You have to think about where you want to be afterwards.
Absolutely. Well, I think that concludes this episode on the takeaways from the recent U.S. News rankings. Thank you, Graham, for joining me. And for our listeners, we hope you'll stay tuned. Our next episode in the series will focus on applying in round three, the pits and pitfalls, the reasons it's absolutely right for some students, and more.
Thanks so much, Jeanette.
Thank you.